Thanks for everybody for sharing these bits of your story with me. I'll go ahead and tell you, across here, you have all anticipated my talk in just about every capacity. So I had sat down and prepared this conversation here, and as we went around the circle, I heard just about everything I'm going to bring up. So there will be no new information for anyone here. So if you need to go get a cup of coffee, feel free. Brother Odo, when I'm not here, folks call me Barrett. And I first came here in 2014. And for many of you who are here in the circle, I met you that week. And it was a memorable one for me, because I came here first in a moment of crisis. It was after my second visit to the emergency room with stress-related illness, and I had been working myself to the bone, sleeping an average of 3 to 5 hours a night, and I had this moment of clarity that came. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and at the time I was working as a Presbyterian pastor in Kalamazoo, and at 2 a.m. I was sitting in my office and had this moment of clarity of going, who does this? Why is it strictly necessary for me to be at 2 a.m. still working here in my office? I haven't seen my wife or my kids all day, and I've been here for many, many hours straight here, and that this is not being a diligent worker, and I've been to the ER twice. I need to find a new rhythm. I need, the words in my head were, I need something grounded and balanced. Who understands grounded and balanced? Monks. Okay. Are there any monasteries near me around here? And I did a Google search, and St. Gregory's Abbey popped right up. I'm like, oh, cool. Episcopal Monastery, Benedictine. I had read the Rule of St. Benedictine Seminary, but kind of looked it over, didn't give it much of a thought after that. And but I thought, oh, yeah, I know what that's about. I'll book a retreat. I'll go. And I did. I came here that week, met a lot of you that week. And coming here, I'm not quick to say that such and such a thing changed my life, but that week did. There was a definite before and after of that week. Sitting here in the Abbey Church that week, for the first time in my life, I felt quiet on the inside. That had never happened to me before. You mentioned, Mark, I also live with ADHD, and there's a lot of stuff going on in my head all hours of the day or night, and to feel quiet on the inside for the first time was a new experience. Amazing. Yeah, and it's been really life-changing for me in how I approach work and how I approach family life. I discovered a new rhythm here, and like you were saying, Christian, talking about my concept of time and how time works, that's actually going to be my central point that I want to talk about today.
You're welcome.
So yeah, you guys have anticipated everything here. Along with that, not just a way of life, but I think the broader, far deeper reaching experience that I had. I grew up in a rather conservative evangelical environment, like some other folks here have, and came to a point in my adulthood of needing to distance myself from that particular stream of the Christian tradition, and had several years of experiencing a dark night of the soul. I just kind of wasn't sure what I believed anymore. And I thought, am I still even a Christian? Do I even believe in God? And all of it was a big old question mark for me. But coming here that week, not only did I feel quiet on the inside, but also sitting in that church, I feel like I met Jesus again in a new way, in a way that I had not experienced before. And that also, I think maybe even that primarily, was the life-changing part of that. And I have been chasing that experience ever since. And I knew after that week, I need to figure out a way to take some of this back home with me. This is the grounded and balanced I came here looking for. And I've been coming back ever since. I joined the confraternity a little later that year. And with Brother John Mark, we were clothed as oblate novices together 2 years ago. And, so still feel like the new guy in very many ways. And a lot of folks have been here longer than I've been a part of that. So to start in on what I wanted to talk about today. When St. Benedict sat down to write his rule in the 6th century, he was living in a time of pretty massive cultural transition. It was a civilization in decline, and much like ours is today, about 100 years before he was writing, Rome had been sacked by the Goths and Visigoths, and the Roman Empire was beginning to break up. He's also writing on the heels of a group of people known as the Desert Fathers or Desert Mothers. And they were a group that formed about 200 years before Benedict lived. And their movement emerged around the time in the 4th century when Christianity was legalized in the Roman Empire. And the church went from being a small, persecuted fringe movement to being at the center of imperial power. And suddenly, power and money was pouring into the church. And Christians had all of this influence for the first time. And the Desert Fathers and Mothers were the people who looked at that and said, this doesn't seem to be what Jesus was teaching us about. This was not the kind of life he lived, and he came to save us, he came to show us a new way to be human, and we're thinking that the pursuit of money and power is not it. He stands for something else, and so now that we as Christians have this money and power, it means we have to be intentional in pursuing the kind of life that Jesus is calling us to live. And so they went out into the desert to battle their own inner demons and to practice spiritual disciplines in order to live that kind of life. And their movement started with them. It grew and developed in several different directions. And in Western Europe, St. Benedict laid the groundwork of what became the most common monastic practice in the West, which is now here in North America and around the world, and is the Benedictine order. What I think is really cool about the Benedictine order, and this is my favorite thing to say about the Benedictines, is that they saved civilization by accident. I love saying that about them, because what Benedict felt called to do and how he was trying to embody the kind of life that Jesus is calling us to live is he felt called to found a community of round-the-clock prayer and just constant prayer day and night, seven times a day like we heard from the psalm, and just praying without ceasing. And he sat down and thought really well, okay, how do we do this? How do we do it in a way that's sustainable, in a way that's stable? And the rule grew out of that sense of call. And the whole goal of it was not to reform society. Like we said, it was a civilization in decline. It was a church that had gotten in bed with money and power. But Benedict didn't set out to reform society or even the church. He said, no, I'm just called to pray. And to found a community of prayer. And by accident, in pursuing that, he ended up living out what Jesus said in the Gospels in his Sermon on the Mount. He says, seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness, and then all of these things will be added to you as well. That's how Benedict and the Benedictine order saved civilization. They came to found this community of prayer and developed a stable system of community around that. And that ended up giving Europe exactly what it needed to survive the Dark Ages, the Black Death. The cultural treasures of Western Europe were preserved in Benedictine monasteries. Kings and popes were educated within their walls. They had education, they had health care, they had food and shelter, they had medicine, libraries. And so in all of these ways that go beyond spirituality but are based in spirituality, the Benedictines changed the world. But that was never their goal. They didn't set out to reclaim Europe for Jesus. They just said, no, we're just called to pray. But by accident, they ended up saving civilization. One of the things that really struck me, as I mentioned before, and that you brought up, Christian, that I think is a key feature of how they were able to do that and how we are able to continue that work as Benedictines today, is in that concept of time. And this is something that I think applies to all of us as members of the confraternity, as oblates. I've heard oblates, confraters, associates, different names for us, described as being the arms of the monastery into the world. We are a part of the Benedictine community. We are not monks and nuns. You know, we've got jobs, spouses, kids, cars, houses. We live out here in the broader secular world. We take the rule with us, we take these Benedictine practices with us, and we are supported, as a lot of folks have said already, by the prayer of the monks here at St. Gregory's and also other monastic communities around the world. But we are the arms of the monasteries reaching into the world, and we live an adapted form of the rule, but that doesn't make our calling a lesser one. It's just a different one. And the ways that we embody that are, in a way, sitting with the one foot on either side of the border. We have one foot planted here at the monastery and one out in the world. And we hold both of these together. It's a different calling than that to be a monk or a nun. But it's also significant because without folks reaching out into the world, how is the message of this spirituality going to spread beyond the walls of the monastery? So that's our job. That's why we're here. We take the monastery with us. And to bring it back to time, one of the ways that we do that, and one of the ways that this spirituality is very countercultural, as you said, is that we approach time in a way that is very different from the world around us, especially here in the modern and now postmodern world. In the world that we live in, time, and we're all raised to think of time in this way, is a line. It is an arrow that goes in one direction. We have the past behind us, we're in the present, we're moving toward the future. And in thinking of time as a line, a lot of assumptions come with that about who we are and how we're supposed to live our lives. And this is very much grounded in modern ideas that if time is a line, then we're supposed to be improving ourselves. We're supposed to be looking to get bigger and better, faster, more. It's this idea of infinite growth. And so more power, more wealth, more pleasure, more accumulation of stuff. When we sit and we talk, whether it's in our professional lives with businesses, we think, well, we've got to grow our profit margin. We need more money. In our churches, too, we talk about, well, whenever someone's hiring a new priest or pastor, they'll say, well, how are you going to grow this church? Which is a good question to ask, but I find that oftentimes the churches that have called me, they're, when you really get down to what they mean by grow, they mean more people, more money, more power, which You know, again, I think if we listen to the desert fathers and mothers saying, is that really what Jesus came to teach us about? But it's us buying into this linear concept of time. What I think we experience here at the Abbey, and part of the message that I think Benedict has been trying to get across to us for 1,500 years, is that time is actually not a line. And we've been mistaken in that. Time is actually cyclical. Time is a circle. And if you look at a lot of clocks, I don't know, do we have one in here? I don't see one around.
On my wrist.
Oh, there we go. So, but yeah, if we look at an analog clock, it's a circle. It goes around. Thanks, Christian.
You bet.
It goes around. And in some clocks, and I've seen this on a lot of watches or clocks too, if you notice, the 12 and the 6 and the 3 and the 9, sometimes those are the only marks you'll see. But if you notice, they make the shape of a cross, which I think is pretty cool. And those are the traditional times at which the liturgy of the hours was said. We have the terse, sext, and none, and same with, 3, 6, and 9. And time just goes around in a circle. This concept of time, thanks Christian, you don't have to sit there all day.
Starting to feel like Moses holding the staff.
There you go. Yeah, holding the staff. Thanks. This is actually a really biblical view of time. When we read the biblical stories of, say, the Passover in the book of Exodus, we know the story where, the Jews were slaves in Egypt and God liberated them, and there was this meal that was created as they were on their way out of Egypt, and God commanded them to celebrate this meal year after year at the same time every year, cyclically, along with several other holidays that that God told them to celebrate. And when they would celebrate this, the children would ask certain questions of the parents. And the question that the kids would ask is, why is this night different from every other night? And the parents would answer, because this is the night that God led me out of slavery in Egypt. It doesn't say led our ancestors. It doesn't say that God led the Hebrew slaves. It's not them, it's me. And the idea being that as we celebrate these feasts liturgically, whether it's the Passover or other holidays, time is cycling back around and we are joining our ancestors at this moment in time. So we are making the journey out of Egypt. It was God led me out. It's significant when we get to the New Testament, when Christ institutes the Eucharist at the Last Supper, that it's also a Passover Seder that he does this at. So there, Jesus is very intentionally taking on that cyclical view of time again, where he's saying what's happening here in this moment at this table is happening in a sense in the same time that God has led the Jews out of slavery in Egypt. This is a part of that same eternal moment that we are cycling back around to. And the Eucharist is instituted there, which, of course, we in the church continue week after week. So every time we just got done saying Mass over there, every time we go to Mass, we are rejoining both of those moments. We are joining Christ at the table with his apostles at the Last Supper. We are also joining the Jews as they are being liberated from slavery in Egypt. It is one moment where all of time and space is gathered together that we cycle back around to constantly. Mm-hmm. That is continued not just at the Mass, but also here, as we've talked about, in the Liturgy of the Hours, where we are praying without ceasing at these hours as the hands of the watch go around day after day, and we hit these hours again, chanting these psalms, offering our prayers to God, meditating on Scripture. We're cycling around again, and we're seeing again that time is not a line. Time is a circle. And if we come to approach time as a circle, it changes some of our assumptions about who we are and how we live our life. As we mentioned before, our modern world brings certain assumptions about what good is. And I want to make sure that we don't run out of time here, but...
Because it's just a line.
Oh, look at that. I fell right into it. Look at this.
Jumped right
good,
on.
I know. Look at this. Nice. Good call. Some of the value, the modern values that kind of get injected into us without our being aware of them are things like success, mobility, information, being heard. And I think Benedict, and through this cyclical view of time, challenges some of those core things. And I want to address a few of them. In the modern world, we're told to value success. You know, and we talked about economically, we want economic growth. In churches, in businesses, in just about every institution we're part of, it's like, oh, we need to grow. We need to get bigger, better, faster, more. The thing that Benedict counters that with is instead of success, Benedict values fidelity, faithfulness. Mm-hmm. You know, you can achieve wealth and power, but what is the purpose of that? What does it mean? And so in its place, Benedict says it's faithfulness to the monastic life, faithfulness to the cyclical pattern of prayer and worship, of being a part of what God is doing in the world. We circle back around, and it's about staying faithful, practicing fidelity to that. I think we see that really significantly in the chapters in the Rule when Benedict talks about the qualities that make for a really good abbot. And when we think about, you know, what makes for a good leader, you know, we talk about charismatic personalities. We talk about people who have lots of information, or they're able to impose their will on others in order to get things done. And Benedict doesn't actually think about that. When he outlines the qualities that make for a good abbot, he's actually drawing from St. Paul's writing in the New Testament, when St. Paul talks about what makes for an effective bishop or deacon or presbyter. What they have in common is they talk about character. They talk about fidelity, faithfulness. They talk about who we are on the inside, not so much about what we're able to do on the outside. And that's a standard of success that I don't think our modern secular world really understands at a fundamental level, partially due, I think, to our concept of time. So that's that first one, is success. Along with that, our culture values being heard. And I don't think I'm going to hit these in the order I named them in, but I'm going to try to hit them all. We value being heard, speaking. You know, we'll talk about, oh, I like this leader of a certain kind. He's a straight shooter. He says what's on his mind. In contrast to that, Benedict emphasizes listening. And... you know, Beth, you were sharing part of your story and the monk that you met at camp, and Brother Ian, was it? And you said that, you know, when you first talked to him about what you were going through, he said, well, I don't know what I can do about it, but I can listen. I think it's not a coincidence that the very first word written in the Rule is ausculta in Latin. It's listen. It's listen, my child, with the ears of your heart. This is the advice of one who loves you. And listening is at the very core and the beginning of Benedictine spirituality. And it's in contrast to that. And I think that's part of that fidelity to the cycle of time, is learning how to listen, letting the tones of the Psalms get into us, even if we don't quite understand them, because a lot of days I don't either, but letting them kind of get inside of us, and we keeping coming back and keeping listening to that and staying faithful to that cycle as we go around and keep listening. And through that, learning not just to listen to Scripture, but listen to each other. Listen to the people around us. Benedict's teachings on hospitality and how we treat other people. We treat the person next to us or the person in front of us, whether it's a king or a panhandler. We treat that person as if it was Christ himself. And we give that same honor, the same affection, that same respect And that's pulling straight out of Jesus in Matthew 25. And he says, whatever you do for the least of these who are my brothers and sisters, that's what you do for me. And I think that also comes straight out of St. Benedict's teaching on fidelity, on listening, tying back into his concept of time. So modern culture emphasizes success. To that, Benedict says fidelity. Modern culture emphasizes being heard. To that, Benedict says, listen. Modern culture emphasizes mobility, specifically what we call upward mobility of, you know, every job we have, it's a stepping stone to the next job. We want to learn to get promoted. We need to promote ourselves. We need to do that in order to be better producers. And instead of mobility, what Benedict emphasizes is stability, which is directly related to fidelity, faithfulness. It's not about getting what you can get out of a situation or a job or a person or a marriage. It's about being committed to a particular place, a particular community, to a group of people, expecting that you're going to meet Christ in them. You're going to look into the eyes of another person and see God staring back at you. And stability is about staying still and listening long enough to get to see that. And if we're following this culture of mobility, of jumping from one thing, one place, or one relationship to the next, when we live by these values that have been injected into us unconsciously, we miss the presence of God himself, herself, speaking to us in and through particular places and particular people. And it's one more way that Benedict, through this cyclical view of time, is challenging the assumptions that we tend to live with. So what I've covered so far, we said success, being heard, mobility, to which Benedict says fidelity, listening, and the one I just said. Stability. Right. Core. Thanks. You guys know all this stuff. There's no new information coming out here. So
yes, there is.
So these are three of the yeah. So those are three of those connections there. I find that these things have been life-changing, and I'll start to wrap it up, I think, with that. We could keep going all day on this, but so I'll start to wrap it up there. But you can just see from this Taste of Things how it is that this is, as you said, Christian, a countercultural vision. All of us have shared these stories of how this place, this particular place and these particular people, and also the Benedictine stream stretching back for a millennium and a half, has touched our lives. And that by cycling around to this, we've encountered something deeper that has changed us and is still changing us. For me, it has been physically and spiritually life-saving. I approach my family differently. I approach my work differently. I met Jesus again. I found peace on the inside for the first time in my life. It's been mind-blowing to me. And historically, we can see, as I mentioned before, how through this way of living, the Benedictines saved civilization by accident. And so I think that can lead us living in the 21st century to ask, how might that continue through us, through the monastery as it exists here, but also through our own practice of Benedictine spirituality as we live with one foot here at the Abbey and one foot out in the world. And as we take it back, how will that continue to transform us? And I think I'll leave it with that question. And any responses, questions, comments?
When you were in seminary,
yeah,
was there mention or thought about what you're talking about, you know, Benedictine ideas, or what was the basis for the spirituality then?
That's a great question.
My brother was in seminary, and I used to visit him. He went to Chicago Theological Seminary.
Oh, CBS, very cool. Yeah.
And it seemed like, you know, I was just a teenager, mm-hmm. then, but it seemed like they talked about more when I would be in a group discussions mm-hmm. with several of the guys, yeah. all guys, all men. And they talked more about what they were going to do mm-hmm. more yeah. than what was happening within them.
Yeah.
It always interested me mm-hmm. that. And I'd say to my brother, well, you got to be a minister, you know. You're working with people and their emotions and their what's going to happen to them. And they were always talking about situations for all, you know, the big stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it always interested me. And they had a chapel, a Goodrich chapel, beautiful Gothic chapel in the seminary. And once a day, they read like an evening prayer service. But nobody went. I would go, and my brother would go, but none of the other guys were there, you know? Yeah. It was, they were at meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But in these little worship services, there was maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes of prayer,
mm-hmm.
they weren't there. And I used to think, this is really strange, you know? They're going to be ministers, they're going to work with people's souls and
mm-hmm.
their feelings, and yet they're not here. You know, they're off yeah. talking about Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. other stuff. So anyway, I just wondered, in your situation where mm-hmm. you went through this too, the emphasis should be on Benedictine or what, you know, whatever rule there is or what the saints have done or others have done, you know, through the years.
It absolutely should be. You are 100% right. And the good professors in seminaries, they get that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say it is there. It is really easily ignored. And you know, I went to seminary as a young guy. I was in my early 20s, and I missed it. That and looking back now, I can see how a lot of my professors were really trying to introduce me and my fellow students, both men and women, to that these core principles. And I can look back to my shame now and say, it was there, but I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't listening. I think that's part of a function of being a really young guy and just having lots of big ideas about how I'm going to change the world. And I was too busy talking that I wasn't listening. And it took me up until my 30s to let life hit me in the face hard enough that I had to stop and listen. And that's what happened here. So I'd say it is there. In my experience, the fault was with me, not with my seminary. Maybe there are ways that it could be emphasized more. You know, sometimes if we're not listening, God has to shout. So maybe our professors do too, but it's definitely there. But in my case, I had to learn how to quiet my own ego down enough to start listening to what needed to be there.
For a lot of people, that comes with maturity.
Yeah.
It's really hard to be that when you're in your 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, there's an old saying, youth is wasted on the young.
Yeah. Carl Jung, the psychologist, said that the really interesting work of life just doesn't begin until after your midlife crisis. Like that's when the real work happens. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were talking earlier about churches emphasizing youth ministry, which is great and really important. You know, the older adult ministries, that tends to make me think that's where the really interesting stuff can happen. You mm-hmm. know, folks.
Yeah, I see that at the St. John's. We have several older adults who, after their real careers
mm-hmm.
have really started to delve deeply into their biblical studies, into their trying to establish the
mm-hmm.
spiritual connection.
Yeah.
Trying to, as we would say, figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Like we kind of do here, we're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
One of the things that Will Dirksey said in his book is we should not treat the monastery visits as coming in to get your IV full of spirituality. He says, our spirituality needs to be the same at the monastery as it is at home in the world.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a trickier balancing act.
And it's a huge balancing act.
Right.
And if we are doing the things we need to do and following Benedict's rule and the teaching of the brothers here and Christ himself, we are paying attention out in the world as much as we suddenly pay more attention when we get here. Mm-hmm. Because I know I'm guilty of it. I come here and I say, yeah, God, I'm home. Mm-hmm. And I start, okay, this is going on, that's going on. Good. Everything's in order.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that at home, then your life isn't balanced.
But it's so easy to get out of that.
Right.
Oh, very easy. Mm-hmm.
You know, you're home a day and right away your mind is clicking into something.
What do I got to worry about next? What's going on here? What's going on there? Yeah. And that's where Will Dirksen was talking about having that balance of paying attention, whether you're on the basketball court or whether you're in the sanctuary in prayer.
Yeah.
Or talking with somebody or doing the dishes. Mm-hmm. St. Benedict's the great thing about in the rule is, and God bless me, I tried real hard to do this, mm-hmm. and I failed miserably, mm-hmm. is treat everything in your possession as if they were the sacred altar vessels of the altar.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And if you actually try to do that,
yep.
it makes you bonkers, because it's like, how can I? What's the value of this tire as compared to the stuff on the altar, or the value of, you know, paper towels or whatever the case may be?
Yeah.
I actually try always to get the room in the guest house that has that plaque.
Yeah.
If I can get it, I seek that one out if I can get it.
Right. Yeah. And it's straight out of the rule. You know?
And it's straight out of the rule. And you try to, okay, I'm here this weekend. Good. I'm going to go home and I'm energized again. Let's go. Uh-huh. And you go home and for the first 20 minutes,
it's great.
Or the first day or two, whatever the case may be, you're feeling like you're successful.
Yeah.
And you're paying attention to your spouse or the kids or mm-hmm. whatever the thing you're doing. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, ball, squirrel. This is more interesting. Let's watch TV.
Yeah.
Or let's do this. And, and when someone's trying to engage you in a conversation, your mind is like 30 feet over there. And coming back to the prayer every night, we do evening prayer at St. John's 5 nights a week. And quite often it's just me and another fellow who comes down here with our men's group, Eric Nister, and we're our own little Benedictine cohort there at St. John's. And going in there and even on the days where I'm like, God, I don't want to drive over to church just for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But if I start thinking, don't do it, then I get the 2x4 against the back of the head from God. And right. Then I become obedient and I go do it.
Yeah.
And then I feel really great after I've done it.
Yeah.
These are the challenges we have as Benedictines, being here and loving being here, mm-hmm. and learning to be home or in the world and loving that. Just as much attention as we pay here to the bell.
Right. But the good news in that is that it's the same struggle that's been going on all along. You know, when Benedict put that thing in the rule, he says, you know, make sure the utensils of the monastery are treated with the same reverence that the sacred vessels of the altar are treated. He wrote it because he was struggling with that too.
Right.
He saw that same tendency in himself, and it's the same struggle as the desert fathers and mothers when, you know, looking at like the wealth and power of the church and going, this wealth and power, this is not what Jesus is about. Right. How do I stay focused? They struggled with it too. Benedict struggled with it. We're just in the same battle with them. And we struggle with that too.
In that same loop.
Yeah, exactly. and it's exactly, it's the same loop, the same cycle. We're coming back around. And yeah, and by keeping ourselves in the loop with the, you know, in whatever way we're able, I mean, maybe we can't all get up at 4 every morning. Maybe we can't do this 7 times a day, but, you know, once a day.
What about the church today?
Yeah.
when you look at the power and the wealth of the church, mm-hmm. and the way it's shown to the world,
yeah.
today.
Uh-huh.
I mean, look at all this stuff that's done in yeah. the name of the church, and is yeah. this what Jesus would do?
Yeah.
What Benedict would do? You know?
Yeah. Also, the same questions, the same struggles the Desert yeah. Fathers.
And I have that
asked.
Thrown at me
yep.
know, by people.
Absolutely. And, yeah. you know, that question's been asked for over 1,500 years.
Yeah.
And yet, and so we're in that same battle with them. And so again, it's not a line, it's a cycle, and we're coming back around to it. And so we are helped by their example, by their writings. We're helped by their prayers. You know, then the communion of saints, they're still with us, praying for us, praying with us. Yeah, and we're so when we come back around through that cycle, we're joining with them. We're joining with Christ and the apostles at the Last Supper. We're joining with the Hebrews in their exodus out of Egypt. It's we're here in this one eternal moment. We're helped by them, so we're not alone in that struggle. And that's encouraging to me. And yeah, and so I think we've got a lot of good stuff to work with here. And I think the odds are very much in our favor.
This is the book that I've been reading.
Will Dirksey, The Rule of Benedict for Beginners. Cool. Okay, yeah. I dig it.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. Someone else mentioned that to me a few weeks ago.
Cool.
It's an inexpensive book, and Ed, I got this thing highlighted halfway through.
Yeah. Cool.
My second round through it. But.
Awesome. Yeah, well... Thanks for inviting me to share some of my ideas.
Thank you
for anticipating all of my ideas. I certainly hope there was nothing new in that. And having heard your stories, I'm like, man, this crew's got it already. So,
no, I know. Yeah. I kept insisting that I keep talking to you.
Cool.
Yeah, Barrett, I see you brought the book there.
Oh, yeah. This is my breviary.
The bottom here.
Oh, this is the Rule of Benedict, and this is the Bible.
This to my wife.
Yeah, this is a really good, if you don't have a copy of the Rule of your own, I highly recommend this one. It's the Rule of Benedict with a commentary by Joan Chittister. She breaks it up into a 3-month cycle, which is the same one that they follow in the monasteries, so it'll take you through the Rule every 3 months, and... Or maybe it's every 4 months, 3 times a year, I think. But her comments are really good. But it's also just a way of breaking down the Rule into manageable sections, so you don't have to feel like you have to read the whole thing and get it all in one go.
Yeah, that was the first one that I read, and I really liked it.
Yeah. Yeah, really cool. Yeah.
Well, we have to get over to church.
Yep. All right. Well, yeah, thanks for inviting me to share.
Thanks, Barrett.